I sort of view disability from a social model of disability perspective. I guess it's a thing about me and about many other people. It's just a difference, but the ways in which it causes me problems aren't caused by the difference itself, but by the way that society and our careers and our education system are structured and the way that they work.
It's estimated that around 20% of the population are neurodivergent, a term that can include, but is not limited to, autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, and dyscalculia. This video aims to give an insight into the experience of trainees within the NHS who are neurodivergent, exploring how this may present in the workplace, how trainees can be supported, as well as the prejudice that's often faced, and what needs to be done to secure better outcomes.
Neurodiversity is simply a biological fact. It's not a condition, it's not a diagnosis. It's a term that was inspired by the concept of biodiversity, and it relates to the natural range of diversity in human neurocognitive functioning. So really, it's a bit like biodiversity, but for brains.
One of the things that is striking about when people come for diagnostic assessment is that often the first thing they say is that they have always felt different. They've always felt left out and apart from other people. And that has a huge impact on their how they see themselves, how they see the world. And to be part of that community of people who describe themselves as neurodiverse, and that being a positive definition, can be transformational in terms of a feeling of belonging and in terms of feeling less stigmatized.
It's because the impact of not recognizing neurodivergence can be really profound in terms of one's self-esteem, mental health, career impacts, and ultimately life course. So it's really important.
The signs were there literally my whole life, and I think people had suggested to me in the past that maybe I might have ADHD.
Alice received a formal diagnosis of her ADHD in May 2020, just before completing her undergraduate degree. She's now a trainee clinical scientist.
It definitely has had an impact on my training. Like, I think I have a lot of difficulties with kind of concentration, organisation, I think kind of auditory processing, I find that very difficult. If someone says something to me, I don't remember it.
Being autistic, I'm not really able to pick up on the cues, like that I'm not very good at the social and communication stuff. That's sort of the reason why I'm bad at it, is I'm not able to pick up on these sort of hints and these sort of social, sort of unwritten social rules.
There is a core set of traits or symptoms which we would expect to see when someone has a diagnosis of autism. So there are certainly differences around communication. So that may be the integration of verbal and nonverbal communication, understanding others' sort of nuances of communication, or how or an unusual or different communication style.
It's deeply upsetting to realize that we have been giving messages that are unintended. Deeply upsetting to realize that we've been hurtful to colleagues, or to be condescending, or to, you know, just be perceived as unfriendly, when that's not our intention at all.
Devon was only diagnosed with autism during medical school, but did not manage to qualify.
So I think that perhaps had my advisors said, Devon, you're, or had they sort of probed a bit into, do you need some more help with this? And saying, oh, actually, you're not, this is really, you're not picking up the points for these in your assessments, and it's really dragging your grades down and making it difficult for you to pass. You need a bit more help with this.
Feedback is often delivered in a way that's not quite clear enough for an autistic person. So a supervisor may couch the issues in language that is meant to soften, for example, a blow if the feedback is negative. But quite commonly, that doesn't necessarily land with an autistic trainee in the same way that it might with a non-autistic trainee, for example. And then what can happen is that the reaction to that feedback is not as expected, But the reason is that the message hasn't been heard.
Despite their achievements, by the time they've failed the AKT three times, they're starting to have serious doubts about their intelligence.
David McLaughlin and Susanna Whitwell conduct diagnostic assessments for people who are struggling in education or employment.
And one of the advantages of doing the sort of testing that I do is I can say to somebody, look, your verbal ability is in the top 5% for the population. You've got really good visual spatial ability. Yes, you should be pursuing surgery. Or yes, you should be doing this. So I'm reinforcing the idea that it's not a stupidity issue.
Having the diagnosis clarified can be helpful in terms of the individual's own understanding about their strengths and weaknesses, also for people around them, and obviously for the workplace to understand where there may be difference.
Devon is now a clinical scientist, and this time around, with their previous experiences, they were able to do things differently.
From day one, I started applying for access to work funding. I asked for an Ask for Work assessment. They suggested that I get a mentor, somebody to come and, you know, like talk to me. And they also suggested some co-coaching.
That opened my eyes to what actually is a neurodiversity, how people respond differently, how putting them in certain environments is not conducive to getting the best out of them.
My sort of overall supervisor for my training, he was quite engaged in my training, which is not always the case with everybody. So we talked about how he could sort of change the way that he did things to suit me better.
Building kind of a relationship where being open and honest with each other, having more structured approaches, trying to avoid wherever possible distractions that might come into play that can lead to confusion and can lead to perhaps going off track of what the training scheme expects of you.
There are two elements. One is making sure that the environment and the workplace is a workplace that is conducive to neurodiversity and is neurodiverse friendly, I suppose is one way of putting it. So, and that might be more general support for the team in terms of training around neurodiversity and knowing what it is and what it isn't. But certainly if you have a trainee who is neurodiverse, part of what you'd be doing is thinking about their individual strengths and weaknesses. This can be very individual, you know, rather than just assuming there is a set of positives and negatives, there may well be a little bit of exploration with the trainee about what support they need. And then thinking about whether there are adaptations that are needed to that post.
As well as being a trainee supervisor, David runs a busy laboratory.
It's quite difficult within that setting to, without support presenting itself to you, you know, to know where to turn, and that there should have been some support network in place that both prepared me for what I might need, but also gave me an idea of what resources were available in those situations. Unfortunately, I do feel very much that I was in the dark. And as I say, it was only because my trainee knew about these things that we were able to chart a route forward.
I suppose part of what motivates me to talk about this is that an awful lot of people my age with ADHD are in prison. And if I hadn't been brought up with the opportunities I had, that might have happened to me.
Our fourth trainee contributor is a junior doctor. He's chosen to remain anonymous and has not declared his diagnosis of ADHD and dyslexia at work. His words are being read by an actor.
My director of studies at university made me sit a fitness to practice ADHD assessment before I became a doctor, and the consultant I saw in Cambridge told me he thought it was best if I didn't mention having ADHD to people when I became a doctor. And so I didn't, and I changed the way that I probably operated, and I stopped being open about having ADHD, and I just didn't tell anyone, and I just tried to be the same as everyone else. So I've never told occupational health about it. And the other reason is that when I was at Cambridge, I used to get extra time in exams. And I used to have lots of pejorative comments made by people that it wasn't fair that I got extra time in exams and that I was no different from anyone else. That having ADHD and taking Ritalin, if they took Ritalin and had extra time, they would all do better as well. And it was basically like taking a performance-enhancing drug. And I think they're the things that people still think deep down about ADHD. So to be honest, I think life is easier if you don't mention it.
The prejudice comes from ignorance, like all prejudice. And if people's understanding of dyslexia or ADHD or dyspraxia or whatever is incorrect, then they will be discriminated against, often not maliciously.
We've had trainees removed from training purely because they have disclosed a diagnosis. We have had trainees where supervisors were unwilling to sign them off, for example, on their final exams just because they were autistic. And, you know, well, how can you be a surgeon if you're autistic? How can you be a psychiatrist if you're autistic? Absolute discrimination, a complete misunderstanding of what it takes for us to thrive. We don't need much to thrive. We do need understanding and accommodations, and we can absolutely be really good doctors.
I write my report in three sections, actually, and that's become my practice. It has an appendix of scores. It has a middle bit that says I interviewed and assessed this person and so on. And then the first three or four pages have a bullet-pointed summary, and then they talk about how people can be supported and so on. And I say to people, the whole thing will go to the PSU or whatever. But if you just want to be better understood by your educational supervisor, just give them the first four pages. Because it's got no scores on it, but it says this is how this person can be supported. This is what you can do about it. Okay, but it really does come down to individuals being able to educate other people. And if they're comfortable in their understanding of what they're dealing with, then they might be better prepared to do that.
Generally, like, I'm quite open with telling people. I think I'd almost prefer people new so that they kind of understand me better and understand why I am the way I am.
Alice has been open about her diagnosis at work and receives specific support from her supervisors.
They have really tried to support me as much as possible. I think it's kind of been a bit of a process of trying to find what works, and I think we're still kind of going through that. For example, obviously the exercising or star jumps. I think my manager also kind of incorporated like a monthly exercise challenge for our department to kind of encourage a bit of movement. Actually, one thing she came up with was like flashcards with the kind of key things that I need to do for the day. I mean, yeah, it seems a bit childish, but it works well. So just like basically cards with the key things I need to do, and then once I'm done, I kind of move it onto my done pile. I think that was good to help kind of clearly define all the different things that I needed to do and make sure I didn't forget things or I didn't kind of get overwhelmed. I could just take one at a time.
Making accommodations for autistic and otherwise neurodivergent colleagues, that benefits everybody. It benefits our neurotypical, non-autistic colleagues because communication is so much clearer. But really importantly, it benefits the patients as well, because the healthcare outcomes for autistic patients are not good. And so much of it is down to a lack of understanding of the issues in healthcare.
It needs to be thought about at a trust level, in the same way that there have been huge changes within the general public about how we think about neurodiversity. I think this isn't always reflected by changes in the medical community. That is, there is still a lot of stigma and a lot of misinformation about what it means to be neurodiverse. And so thinking about that more generally within NHS trusts, not just when you are confronted by someone who is neurodiverse, would be a really helpful way forward.
Medicine needs all kinds of minds. Medicine needs neurodivergent minds. So many of the innovations, the advances in medicine have been because of people thinking differently. Quite often you have a situation where a patient's symptoms don't necessarily fit into a standard category. And it really does take somebody to come and look at things differently from a different perspective to find the solution to a clinical conundrum. So yeah, absolutely. Medicine needs us. Medicine needs all kinds of minds.
For further information and support, go to the website and search for neurodiversity resources. There you'll find links to organisations such as Genius Within, Cognosist, and resources specific to particular diagnoses. keep checking back, as the list is constantly being added to.